Well met, and welcome to episode 24 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for December 20th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to continue our month-long discussion of the third part of Henry VI with DVD reviews of two different television productions, plus we'll do our usual recap of this week's blog entries. We have two DVDs to review this month. As usual, we have a production from the early 1980s BBC Collected Works series, as well as the third part of Henry VI segments from the 1960 BBC Shakespeare's An Age of Kings. Let's start with the Collected Works production. As part of the Henry VI sequence, it has the same director and much of the same cast as Henry VI-1 and VI-2. This production, done in 1983, was directed by Jane Howell, who also helmed the Titus Andronicus from this series. While Part 1 was wildly tonally schizophrenic, wacky humor with dead seriousness, and Part 2 less so, the humor was mostly sardonic and wry, here, what humor there is played either between characters or in asides. Howell guides her production with an almost Titus-like seriousness in the face of over-the-top violence. And this is seen right up front. The play opens with a lingering shot of dead bodies. Then, in a nod to the first two parts' usage of a sheet with the title scrawled on it, the title sheet is then pulled over to cover the bodies. Later, when we meet Rutland briefly before he's killed, he is very young, making Clifford's cruelty all the more horrific. York's capture is very much like the bear-baiting spectacles that Shakespeare's audience would have seen outside the globe. And Richard's final act killing of Henry is brutal, brutality punctuated by Richard's ironic and sarcastic asides. Now turning to the acting, there are three performances here that are just flat-out brilliant. Julia Foster's Queen Margaret builds on her characterization from the first two parts. Since Suffolk's death, she has become visibly older, and not necessarily in years, but in grief. Her hair pulled back, always covered either in a hood or a crown or a military helmet, she becomes the she-wolf of York's tirade. There is very little femininity left in her. Even her protection of Prince Edward is animalistic, not humanely maternal. She delivers her lines with, and I know this is going to sound oxymoronic, but a kind of invested detachment. Margaret is into everything she says, but she doesn't want it to seem that way. And this makes her mocking of York and her sarcastic toss-offs to Edward, her minions comment especially, all the more biting. It is a great performance. Now also great is Mark Wing Davey as Warwick, looking astonishingly like Gary Oldman in the first 10 minutes of Francis Coppola's film Bram Stoker's Dracula, and you gotta wonder if Francis saw this. He makes for an aristocratically dashing warrior. Imperious, noble, but human in his desire for revenge for the perceived disrespect Edward sends his way. He plays many parts, thoughtful advisor to York, loving uncle to George when the boys learn of their father's death, kingmaker to Edward, but the tension between Warwick and Richard is palpable. It is a solid performance. And of course that brings us to Richard and Ron Cook's bravura turn as the crookback. When he learns of his father's death, his care and hurt is well played, especially in comparison to the measured tones of Edward's tearful grief. When we learn of Richard's ambition, Cook builds his soliloquy, showing us the evil bubbling up in Richard, starting cool, then simmering, then boiling over. His soliloquy over Henry's body, too, is a lesson on building momentum. It's going to be very interesting to see his performance in Richard III. Will it also build, or will it start off in full swing? I can't wait to find out. Now, another reason why I can't wait is I'm becoming more and more a fan of Howell's direction. She's great with actors, but it's the little touches that blow me away. In the scene before the boys learn of York's death, and Edward and Richard watch in amazement as they witness three suns appearing in the sky and becoming one, Howell adds George to the scene, and we see them in profile as they watch the sight. They are three suns watching three suns, illuminated by those suns in the sky. It's a great moment. Well played, too, is the two-soldier sequence with Henry. It takes on an almost dreamlike feel as Henry is not standing above looking down on them, but on the field with them, so close as to touch. In a sense, he's become a spirit. He was never a man. And he's melting in and around these real men, these real warriors. The end, too, is wonderfully staged. There is a celebration in the palace, with everyone breaking into dance, except Richard, who who really is alone. He has to fight his way through the dancers to get to the door of the palace. There, he turns around and scornfully looks back on the revelers, then pushes his way through the doors, which close with a bang. Yeah, I can't wait for the next part of the series. Okay, so that was the early 80s BBC Collected Works production. Let's transition to the 1960 BBC's Shakespeare's An Age of Kings sequence of history plays. Like all but Henry VI Part 1, the third part of Henry VI is broken into two episodes. The Morning's War and The Sun in Splendor, both directed by the director of the entire series, Michael Hayes. The Morning's War takes care of the first half of the play, up to Richard's soliloquy revealing his ambitions for the crown at the end of Act 3, Scene 2. In the Battle of Towton, Hayes makes an interesting change to the text. Richard kills Clifford, so there is no post-mortem taunting of the body by the York boys. And it works dramatically. Henry's speech over the battle is a great performance by Terry Scully as he continues playing Henry as weak. The only problem is that the music underneath is too much and the scene goes on a little too long. The soldiers, father and son scenes, are interesting though. They speak to the camera while Henry stares off into space, nicely showing his distance and detachment from the common man. Lady Grey, as played by Jane Wenham, walks a fine line between politic and flirtatious with Edward and her partition. Richard is obviously disgusted by Edward's lust, and it leads to Richard's ambition soliloquy. And as long as he's focused on the situation at hand, he talks to the air as if discovering the words as he goes. But when he previews his villainy, he turns to the camera. Very effective, bringing us in as co-conspirators, especially given Paul Daneman's comic but subtle performance. Even his physicality is sudden. His is hardly a hunchback. He comes off wickedly charming. As for some of the other performances, Jack May as York doesn't seem nearly as ambitious as he did in the previous episodes, which makes Mary Morris as Queen Margaret even harder, more flinty, incredibly cruel. Jerome Willis as Clifford is animalistic, hell-bent on revenge, and his eye patch might have seemed funny if he weren't so damn intense. And Julian Glover as Edward is perfectly imperious, smug, and handsome, all allowing us to see him as the wanton king. In the second hour, The Sun in Splendor, John Warner makes the French King Louis a comic fop, while Frank Windsor's Warwick is a slick political operative. Patrick Garland as George, Duke of Clarence, is seen in multiple scenes as either drinking or drunk. And if I remember Richard III correctly, George is drowned in wine. So if that memory serves, this is really a neat bit of foreshadowing, and if not, it certainly explains George's constantly changing alliances. In this version, Warwick doesn't enter Act 5, Scene 2 already wounded, but rather killed on stage by both Edward and George. George goes even as far as stabbing Warwick in the back. They both then abandon him to die. Now, when Margaret enters the battlefield armored, she has no femininity at all. If she didn't tell us she was a woman, we might not have known it. And in the final banquet, Hayes makes a couple more great choices. Edward's kiss of his wife is long, inappropriate, and a little uncomfortable. Think of Al and Tipper's kiss at the 2000 Democratic Convention. We certainly get the vibe of wanton Edward there. Then, when Richard kisses the infant Prince Edward, the baby cries and continues to do so for the remainder of the scene. Nicely done. So the verdict? Both the BBC Collected Works series and Shakespeare and Age of Kings are available on both Netflix and Amazon, and both are highly recommended. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including women in history, the history of Henry VI, that is, Northumberland's and Somerset's and Grey's, oh my, Henry VI, Episode 3, A New Hope, Henry VI is History, Part 3, Historical Timeline, and even more historical inaccuracies. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Or become a fan of our Facebook page. But remember, the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. Now, this is the podcast for December 20th, so the next one is for December 27th. And by then, Christmas will have already come and gone. So, happy holidays to everybody. And we hope to see you back when we come back. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for December 20th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.